Welcome to Fooky Cafe. I'm Ivy Cohn, and today's guest is Dylan Thompson. Well, Dylan, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, Ivy.
Well, your claim to fame in the most recent years is as the co-founder of Fertile Ground Institute, mm-hmm. Environmental Institute, mm-hmm. and an activist mm-hmm. In environment and social justice, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is at the top of your list right now?
Top of my list is the same thing that's been there for the past 5 or 6 years that I've been politically active, which is climate change, mostly, the death of the planet and the ecological foundation of life as caused by human activity, and more specifically industrial civilization. So that's really been my focus, and that is sort of the umbrella under which a lot of other smaller struggles have been occupying my time, whether it's indigenous resistance to colonial imperialism or pro-feminist work, helping women in their struggle for liberation against patriarchy, other social justice work, and then local eco-justice campaigns. So a lot of stuff going on, but the umbrella is climate change and what this culture is doing to the planet as a whole.
Mm-hmm. That really mm-hmm. is the overarching picture.
Yeah.
And that human activity that has, in both the social and economic, as well as the destruction of the climate that followed on from that,
mm-hmm. right.
that human activity has brought us to this current state of dire affairs.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Before we launch into a little chat about, you know, extinction events, mm-hmm. can you just share how you personally, you know, from your early young life came through to be to this place?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, I can only really guess as to what factors really pushed me in the direction that, you know, made me end up where I am right now. But the way I'm thinking about it today is just, you know, I grew up in a rural part of Western Washington State, on 5 acres with a lot of animals. My parents really liked to get, you know, we had a menagerie of different critters growing up. And so I think that non-human relationship, even though it was a domesticated human, domesticated animal relationship, you know, that teaches you something about non-humans. But beyond that, across the street from my parents' property was a meadow, which was home to many wild animals that I spent a lot of time watching and listening to, whether it was elk, coyotes, foxes, bobcats, mm-hmm. deer, you know, a whole ecosystem was going on across the street, and I really do feel like that was a large part of my priming to be an activist, I think. And then it never really found expression in terms of, you know, I never felt the need to speak out about what this culture was doing, mostly because I didn't know what this culture was doing or the extent of the damage. And I went through high school as a normal-ish kid. I liked reading books. And by the time I got to college, I started to have some sort of anti-establishment sentiment, so to speak, I think, because I liked, you know, beat poetry from the 50s and got into a lot of music from the 60s and 70s and started learning about the culture back then and, you know, anti-establishment resistance movements, you know, the movement against the war in Vietnam and a lot of the student uprisings that went on back then inspired me to start thinking about things differently. And when I got to college, I met some folks who put some books into my hands and that really, really changed things for me. And I think I have anthropology to thank for really steering me in the direction of becoming anti-agriculture and anti-civilization in the end, particularly the book Ishmael, written by Daniel Quinn, fit in with what I was learning in my cultural anthropology class, learning about the ways that humans have lived on this planet. You know, for 99% of our existence on this planet, we were hunter-gatherers. You know, we were subsistence farmers. And as many stories as I was told growing up about how that life was brutish, short, primitive, not as good as this civilized way of life that we have, I started learning things that contradicted that story. And even in a university anthropology class, I was learning that the average hunter-gatherer works 20 hours a week. And that work is difficult, sure, but it's going out with your family and friends to hunt and to you know, make a garden and get what you need to survive. And, you know, that just led me on a path of different books and talking to different people and reading science and news and looking at what's going on in the dark corners of the world. You know, who's making the clothes on the backs of the people who are walking around me? Oh, I mean, it's mostly sweatshop labor in so-called third world countries. You know, what's going on in these places that are, you know, not what I was used to? And so I went through a process of radicalization and realized that there are a lot of problems in the world, and they all seem to stem from the same root, you know, because we didn't always have bombs, we didn't always have mechanized warfare, we didn't always have sweatshops, we didn't always have slavery, we didn't always have the levels of rape that are in this culture. So it was just kind of an organic process for me, and I fell in with the right people and found a group of people who were kind of going along the same educational journey, and that's kind of how it happened for me.
And here we are in the middle of the sixth great extinction, mm-hmm. which is a direct result of the human endeavor.
Yeah. It
sort of took a left-hand turn back there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did.
And, you know, the planet has had a number of extinction events,
mm-hmm.
Five notably that are mm-hmm. often found on the charts.
Right.
And 250 million years ago was the Permian extinction, which was also called the Great Dying, still is called the Great Dying,
mm-hmm.
because it took out, you know, up to 90% of everything.
Right.
And then 65 million years ago, we had, you know, the dinosaurs, which was a result of the earth warming and, you know, the Siberian traps and the lava and et cetera and
right.
so on. So, you know, that was a biggie.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another smaller one at 55 million years that doesn't have any particularly significant attributes that bear on this.
Mm-hmm.
But now we are in the sixth great extinction.
Right.
And this is pretty common knowledge now among people who are paying attention.
Yeah.
And it's getting some airtime out there in the general media as well.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this extinction perhaps differ in your ponderings
mm-hmm.
from the others?
I think it differs in a big way, because, you know, the name for this current extinction that we're in that I've heard over and over again is the Anthropocene. They're calling it the Anthropocene, and that prefix anthro means people, humans. So it's, even in that name, it sort of implies that this is a human-caused event, extinction event. Despite that, I hear a lot of people talk about extinction, you know, this extinction and the previous extinctions, sort of lumping them together, saying that, well, extinction happens. Extinction is a natural thing that happens on the planet. And
to a large degree, this is an accurate statement.
Oh, it is. And I actually 100% agree with them. But then we have to talk about what does natural mean, because it's natural for me to be sitting here talking to you, because we're both people and we both came from this planet, you know, and it would also be natural if you got angry at me and decided to hit me in the face right now, you know. But just because that might be natural doesn't mean it's good if you want a mutually beneficial relationship. So I don't think natural versus unnatural is what we should be talking about. I think what we should be talking about is what we as creatures want on this planet, and what the planet wants as well. So do we want to live here in the future? Do we want humans to have a future, let alone other creatures, the creatures that we're driving extinct with industrial civilization? And I think that should guide our question. We shouldn't get bogged down with, well, this is natural, therefore, you know, throw up your hands kind of thing. We don't need to do much. So
that seems to me, that attitude, to be a, well, it's not my problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a natural event. which takes that responsibility factor out of people's minds.
Exactly. Right.
And I think that whole mindset has been perpetrated, of course, over the centuries upon the domesticated population that we are.
And I personally think about this. It's an ecological issue, and you know, we as bodies are ourselves ecologies. We have our internal ecologies, and when we get sick, you know, we have these intelligences within us. White blood cells, our immune systems have their own intelligences that know what to do when we have a fever, you know, when we get a virus or an infection or something. Our bodies respond. That's responsibility. Our bodies have their own responsibilities. And so I think my work over the past 5-6 years has been trying to inspire an immune response, basically, in the human population to something that I perceive and the people who I work with perceive as sort of a disease. Sure, it's natural, unnatural, whatever. I don't really care about that. What I care about is that something happened 10 to 12,000 years ago that sparked an antagonistic relationship between human culture and nature. And I love humanity, personally. I think humans are beautiful creatures. I also think that wolverines are beautiful creatures, and black rhinos are, and elm trees, and I don't like that this culture is destroying all of these lives, all of these communities. So therefore, I think the appropriate ecological response of humans right now is to form an immune response to dismantle the mechanisms of that disease.
I would just like to try to reiterate that. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that humans might be considering is developing an immune response to the dominant paradigm culture that has wrecked this havoc. And that kind of an immune response, as you pointed out, you know, our immune systems have an intelligence of their own. So in cultivating an immune response to the dominant culture, we can nurture that innate intelligence that is perhaps there to resonate with that.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, talking about natural, unnatural, it feels like if you use your whole body to respond to this, you use your brain and your heart, and it does take courage, I think, in this world, because it's scary. You know, it's scary what's happening to the planet, and it's scary what could happen to you if you decide to fight back. Because once you learn about the problems that are going on, and you learn about the interests behind keeping things going the way they're going, you know, you look at the money, you look at corporate enterprise, you look at capitalism. The system needs things to continue the way they are, despite the fact that climate change might destroy everything and they wouldn't be able to function anyways. It's a scary endeavor to actually form a resistance, to form that immune response. So, but I think it's the human thing to do. That's what I come to these days.
Well, given what we're facing, Dylan, it's scary to think about what's going to come down, possibly, and very probably, in terms of the, you know, I mean, we're in a mass extinction event. That includes humans. And it's not going to be very pretty. And it terrifies me, frankly. I have children, grandchildren. I don't feature the notion of, you know, I also live in the west coast of North America, which means, you know, I'm big fires this year. I could be burned out. I mean, all those things really do kind of send a chill down my spine.
Right.
So if that is a given, why not encourage my immune response and take a stand and resist and, you know, do everything I can to perhaps have some species with enough living members to be able to carry on through this?
Right. Yeah, that's the question, isn't it?
And that really does cause me to take courage and to really fortify myself to face every day what we're up against.
Right. Yeah. There's a quote I love, and I never remember the man's name who said it, but talking about, I believe, a the forest home that he lives in, and I believe it's the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. You know, I am the rainforest fighting back, you know, and it was something like that, and I think we need to embody that kind of mentality too, which brings us to the topic of identity and loyalty, you know, and this is, when I walk around here, what I see mostly is a loyalty, a remaining loyalty to the system, which is understandable because the industrial economy gives most people their access to food and water and shelter. And if industrial culture gives you those things, it's natural to want to defend that thing that gives you those things. But what we're trying to do, and what I've been trying to do, is just try to inspire that sort of forethought of, yes, this is the short-term gain that we have. The short-term gain is that we are going to continue to get what we need to live. The long-term loss is that the system that gives us those things is undermining the ecological framework which is supporting that very system. That system needs healthy forests and healthy prairies and oceans and, you know, a living planet, basically. But it's taking that all away, which means we can't. It's a dead end. It's a dead end road. So the challenge then is to form a movement that has as its goal long-term gain, which might mean short-term loss because it will entail giving up some of those current systems or changing them in some way that make them not harmful.
So. Well, and those systems are not going to, they're not sustainable, right. Obviously, and they may collapse sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. For me, looking at that, knowing that it could be next month, 6 months, where, you know, my bags of stored rice may be the only thing that my family has to eat. Mm-hmm. Just accepting that as a reality in my possibly near-term future, mm-hmm. has helped me to be able to decolonize my mind, mm-hmm. and heart a bit from that dominant paradigm and the systems. Yes, I'm benefiting from it. Yes, it's allowing you and I to sit here and do this.
Yeah.
But I know it's going to go away. Mm-hmm. And knowing that it's going to go away has allowed me to spend more time cultivating a resonance with living systems, which,
right.
you know, watching bugs crawling on rocks is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Listening to the birds.
Right.
Noticing when there are fewer birds.
Right.
Noticing that there are no young hawks.
Mm-hmm.
I drive up and down, commute basically the I-5 corridor up and down the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I would count somewhere between 60 and 80 hawks, mm-hmm. of various ages, mm-hmm. in that 450-mile drive.
Right.
In the last 3-4 years up to present, it's just been a steady decline, mm-hmm. steady decline. And in the last 2 years, I have seen maybe on a trip, 2 years ago, I might have seen 3 or 4.
Yeah.
This year, last month, I did not see one hawk and no babies.
Right.
So noticing and actually being in resonance with these living systems as they're going extinct, mm-hmm. with what's left. Rejoicing with the mama squirrel who's got baby squirrels coming out of the whatever it is,
right.
to nurture that resonance with the living system is, in my opinion, a big piece of the developing of that immune response that you,
mm-hmm.
so brilliantly have,
yeah.
called it.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And I also don't think we should shy away from the feelings of despair and pain and sadness that being in tune with all of these losses will inspire in you, because that is the basis of action. One thing I do a lot of is looking at other movements in the past. You know, what have other people done when they've been faced with desperate situations, whether it's the people in South Africa when apartheid was still in existence, or the resistance to Nazi Germany, you know, these overwhelmingly horrible situations. What did people do? They took that despair and that pain and suffering and being pushed into a corner, and they turned it into action. Not everybody, but resistance movements are birthed out of that kind of soil, the soil of necessity. And what's difficult is trying to get near-term extinction and the results of climate change to be that kind of impetus for fighting back. And the losses of our non-human neighbors, you know, should that, in the ideal world, that should be enough. We should have our loyalty, in my opinion, should be with those hawks and with the prairies that are going extinct. And, you know, talking about driving up and down the I-5 corridor, there are no bugs splattering on the windshields anymore. That's because the wetlands are all being destroyed. And
we won't even get into the number of dead and dying trees and vegetation of
right.
all types, the parched and cracked soil.
Right.
This catastrophe is fully upon us at this point.
Yeah.
And it's not just here. It's global.
It's global.
It's
right.
global.
But we're made of matter, and those things are made of the same stuff, that when we all came from this, the same dirt, you know, and I just think that fighting, you know, the only thing to do in a culture that is taking, you know, sending these creatures and beings off into the longest night of extinction, the only thing to do at this point for me and personally is to fight back. And there are a million ways to do that, but I think the fight has got to be there.
Do you feel, my observation, and perhaps you would feel the same way, is that people who are looking at our dire situation go, mm-hmm. well, why bother?
Right.
Let's party on.
Yeah.
In whatever form that may take in their world.
Yeah.
Because it's pointless, it's going to go extinct, so who cares? That also is a shirking of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is happening, but if you don't do something,
mm-hmm.
then there may be no life systems left.
Yep, exactly.
And so, finding something, I often ask people, you know, with all of the unraveling that we have going on, you know, what is the one thing that brings you to your knees and tears to your eyes?
Right.
There's your passion.
Yep.
Do something in that arena.
Right.
It doesn't matter if it's teeny tiny.
Right.
It takes all of us.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
Doing something.
Yeah. What I say to the sort of let's just party until it goes out is to go back to my metaphor earlier about our bodies being ecologies. You know, we're going to die someday. That's pretty obvious. All of us die. But in the meantime, I hope that my immune system fights back when I do get sick, and that the individual cells that partake in that resistance don't just throw up their hands and say, well, this body's going to die someday, so why fight?
Why bother being a white blood cell?
Exactly.
So I actually am going to start thinking of myself as a white blood cell in the earth system.
Right.
Yeah. Because that's kind of what you're talking about.
It is. I think that attitude, a shirking of responsibility, yes, and also a really sad indication of the disconnect, that we don't identify as earthly beings anymore, that we are, that separation between human culture and nature is really a huge gap. In order for somebody to say something like that, like, yeah, let's just party, you know, I feel very sad when I hear that, because I don't think the connection to this beautiful planet isn't there.
No, and that is something that the dominant cultural paradigm over the last 10,000 years has really worked hard at achieving, is
mm-hmm.
a separation
right.
from the natural rhythm of living systems.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you see as being a mechanism or a tool or an avenue for people to get from that disconnected place back into a connected, honoring space with life?
Yeah. I think you touched on it, honestly. I think if you find something that brings you to your knees and brings tears to your eyes, that to me is the earth, is the source coming up through you and tutoring you into what you should be doing. And you know, maybe your passion, maybe you just can't bring yourself to cry about the loss of the salmon or the loss of the passenger pigeons darkening, that used to darken the skies for days at a time. But there's got to be something. There's got to be something that keeps you going. And if you can find that and think about it, you know, think about where these things come from and just spend some time. I think that's a good start. But I also think that capitalism and this culture has done a really good job at making us feel powerless. It's made us feel powerless by making us feel that the solutions are can only be achieved on an individual basis, which is why you can talk to most people today and they think that riding bicycles and shopping at your local organic natural food store is kind of the extent of environmental action. Sure, there's protesting, sure, there's writing letters to your congresspeople or whatever, but that's a very, very low level of political engagement. And like I was talking about before, apartheid was met by resistance movements, people who were in the above ground, dealing with politicians. Simultaneously, people in underground networks of people were sabotaging industrial equipment of the apartheid regime to get them to listen to the people who were going into office. And we haven't exhausted all the possibilities of resistance yet until we've made a movement like that.
Yeah.
You know? So...
Well, and in fact, I think that that movement is... It could hold huge more numbers of people.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps as the embracing of this notion of, well, if we are going to die sooner rather than later, I think I'm going to do something. I'm going to sit with these feelings of despair and grief and just embrace all of this so that I can move forward with action. Perhaps then more people will come into play mm-hmm. with a real resistance.
Yes.
And it, as I said earlier, I could be out of here next week, which mm-hmm. is why I'm sitting here with you today doing this
right.
and get it out to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right up to the last moment
mm-hmm.
to be engaged with that resistance to the dominant paradigm. Just, well, I love the way Chris Hedges puts it. I mean, we can extrapolate from this comment. He says, I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win.
Right.
I fight fascists because they're fascists.
Exactly.
And, you know, I don't continue doing what I do as a media producer and a bug watcher
mm-hmm.
because I think I'm going to stop the dominant paradigm. I'm going to do it because there is a dominant paradigm.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I love that quote by Chris Hedges.
Yeah, so it's given me a lot of comfort and inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, because then it points to something that, you know, I think the resistance does need to be happening right here, right now. And yes, you think about goals, you think about long term, you think about the chances you have, you think about how big the problem is and how big the culture is, and you can get overwhelmed that way. But if you make resistance and that immune, if you want to be a white blood cell, and if you make that your being and who you are from fingertip to toenail, you know, I think you're not going to get burnt out as easily,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to have the impetus to keep going forward.
And this ties directly into joy,
mm-hmm.
Which is a completely different animal than happiness.
Mm.
Joy has an eternal quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
And people often say, well, how can I find any joy in all this?
Right.
When you are in that place of acceptance and courage and doing action based on your passion, joy springs up here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Unbidden, you notice it.
Right.
And that joy is, and I'm getting little goosebumps as I'm saying this, because it sounds so weird and like it couldn't possibly, you know, it sounds like an oxymoron. How can you be accepting all of this and be in joy? What?
Mm-hmm.
But they're very much related.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that you have really hit on it. It is that really letting this sink down into our being and honoring and loving life
mm-hmm.
from a cellular level.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's so beautiful.
Yep.
I really hope that people can as they hear this conversation, take a little time to really ponder the notion of developing their immune system
yeah.
to the dominant culture.
Right, right. And I guess to sum it up, or the question that I would ask folks is to think about it in terms of loyalty, because the way I see it, there are two sides to me. There are the salmon being driven extinct, and there's that force that's driving them extinct. And while they may have come from the same place, industrial civilization did come from the earth too. But it is, like I said before, it has an antagonistic and a relationship with the earth. And so I think if we want to, if we're questioning where we want to be in the immune system, do we want to be a white blood cell? Really think about your loyalty. Where does your loyalty lie right now? Why does it lie there? What are the things that contribute to you being on the side of civilization versus the side of life, of the planet that's being killed? And really think about it. Just think about it with your heart and your mind. And then follow your heart from there.
Well, following our hearts, that's mm-hmm. a good place to wrap this conversation up,
mm-hmm.
Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
It has been really nice to sit with you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me today.